In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
One of the best benefits of freedom is that it's contagious. As Americans assert and exercise their rights, like freedom of religion and freedom of speech, people in other countries also become emboldened and want the same. But authoritarians see freedom as a contagion, a dangerous virus that can and will spread and must be met with force to stop it. And that's one of the biggest problems with authoritarianism, is that it too is contagious in the sense that wannabe dictators will see other dictators exercising power and they too will want to dominate their citizens, lest they have misguided notions that the freedoms over there in any way apply here. And that's the uniqueness of America, that shiny country, a beacon of freedom. It's easy here, growing up in the land of the free, to forget that others, even our neighbors, don't have the same freedoms and privileges that we do. What you'll hear today is why America is such a unique nation. You'll learn why Canada and other nations are not free nations despite thinking and assuming they were. You'll hear the importance of why America was founded the way that it was and how that is still so important today. But even in America, authoritarianism has been the rule of the day for the last 2 years, and even when you look into it, for decades before. It has gotten far, far worse and more obvious since the Biden administration seized power. But let's not forget that using government to target political opponents has already happened. Obama, with the aid of John McCain and others, used the IRS to target Tea Party groups, everyday people who just wanted to get involved. How quickly we forget. We saw it with the entire intelligence community being unleashed on a political candidate, Donald Trump. And now, misinformation is to be considered as terrorism by Homeland Security. You still have your First Amendment, as long as the government approves it. Freedom is an everyday fight, because there really are people who believe you deserve no rights at all. I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Emord. He is one of America's top constitutional attorneys, and he has a fantastic book out there, The Authoritarians. We definitely recommend that, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page. Jonathan, it is great to talk to you again.
Well, great to be with you again.
Yeah, there's like no end of things happening here that we could be discussing. But before we get going, I'd like to kind of start with a recent event. This is two prosecutors in the Manhattan DA's office that were investigating the Trump Organization and trying to, you know, the typical witch hunt going after Trump there, abruptly resigning. The case had revolved around the investigation into whether Trump inflated the value of his assets in order to obtain favorable loan terms from banks. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that the entire matter is really exaggerated and absurd from the start. The idea that Trump could successfully inflate the value of very large public or very large properties that he owns in such a way as to defraud or deceive large banking institutions into giving him loans is really absurd, because there's so much due diligence that is performed
exactly
by the banks, and these days it's really with large properties and with the number of banking regulations in place, it's virtually impossible for a party to succeed in deceiving a bank as to the value of real property. So I think what happened is that they never had much of a case to begin with. It's politically driven. And so what happened is they never acquired the evidence sufficient to bring a claim against them. And they were searching desperately to find something. Nothing ever came up. So these two prosecutors were probably informed that they had that the case is going to come to a close. And so rather than be there when that happened, they decided that they would bolt. I think that there's a grand jury proceeding, I think, that concludes in April. And I think they're jumping from the ship here before that. It hasn't been convened in a long time, which is indicative of the absence of evidence. Mm. So,
is it possible that Trump could do a countersuit against these DAs in the larger district there in terms of wrongful prosecution? Does he have that? Or now that he's very much a public figure in terms of former president, is that off the table completely?
Well, unfortunately, that would be a civil action. And because this is criminal in nature, you end up being a victim of the... I doubt he would have that ability here. However, the case with the DA from New York, that one, however, I believe is proceeding or will proceed civilly if they wish to pursue it, in which case he would have a basis to go after them for a wrongful prosecution civilly, for malicious prosecution of that case if they proceed civilly.
Mm.
So,
I sure would like to see him hit back at some point. It has just been a witch hunt since he came down that escalator, and would love to see some actual justice in this, but I'm just not holding my breath for that. And then, of course, on Thursday, or actually probably late Wednesday evening, Putin went ahead and called Biden's bluff there. He's now invaded Ukraine. There's been missiles fired, a number of airports that have come under attack, and goodness knows what will happen in the next few days here. Would you care to comment on this situation and any dangers you see ahead?
Yes. So this is the logical and inevitable consequence of having a president of the United States who's both incompetent and weak. Mm-hmm. And the problem is a result of Putin perceiving that weakness and taking advantage of it. It was entirely predictable. For months, it's been predictable, and yet the administration has done nothing. They pursued a response approach rather than taking an affirmative approach where they could upset the nature of the power balance such that Putin would not have invaded. And they've taken domestic actions which have ruined our possibility of benefiting from defenses against the economic hardships that are coming. So, for example, on day one in office, President Biden destroyed the Keystone XL pipeline and signaled that he would get rid of all leasing on federal lands. He just did that and has made us from an energy independent nation to an energy dependent nation. We get about 7% of our gas and oil now from the Russians themselves. We've enriched them enormously.
Yes.
As the price of gas has increased and oil has increased. And we've impoverished ourselves in the process. And this is all due to runaway radical environmental agenda that he bought into, which was really a cover for socialism, as AOC's chief of staff made very clear. So this is part of the picture. The other part of the picture is that Biden did not quickly and in a fulsome way indicate full United States support for the independence of Kiev, of the Ukraine. And he instead waffled and did not supply, for example, lethal weapon systems to enable the Ukrainians to defend themselves, and was slow to jog any EU reaction. So the whole thing has been a disaster, and it comes on the heels of events that have telegraphed to Beijing and Moscow that this new leader of the United States is someone that they understood would be weak and in fact is weak. The ignominious retreat from Afghanistan, leaving it behind Americans, and the sloppy way in which that was done and hasty retreat was indicative of a lack of resolve and intelligence to such a degree. Yes. That they realized the time had come for them to take action. Now his moves now are too little too late. They are not obviously dissuading Putin in the least from full-scale occupation and control of the Ukraine. And there are a number of things that still should and really must be done in order to prevent Putin from using the Ukraine now as a means to intimidate the neighbors,
yep,
both of Russia and of the Ukraine. Yep. such that those neighbors will become patsies.
Seems like they are the next dominoes to fall for sure. Okay, authoritarianism is definitely rearing its ugly head all around the world. Russia invades Ukraine and Canada. Allegedly peaceful Canada goes full Gestapo on peaceful protests. We'll talk more with Jonathan Eamward, author of The Authoritarians. Stay with us. We are talking today with Jonathan Eamward, one of America's top constitutional lawyers and author of the book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Highly recommend that book. And we are taking a look at what is happening in other countries as they embrace authoritarianism. And Jonathan, in that last segment there, you're talking about Ukraine. And do you think our founders ever envisioned a time that America would essentially be the policeman of the world?
No, and they never intended that. Of course, George Washington wanted us to avoid entangling alliances, and their real goal was to ensure the independence and integrity of the United States against any threat. However, having said that, they would certainly regard, and did regard even in their own time, foreign activities, for example, the French and British, and even the Spanish, that affected our country, to be ones that warranted our attention and to some degree our actions. However, the nation did not have the wherewithal at their time to project its power such that it could provide a more fulsome defense of the nation. We have that presently, and as a consequence, the failure to act actually creates a vacuum into which these parties that are intent on our destruction and total elimination of our country take advantage of it, whether it's Iran, whether it's Russia, whether it's China. What China, and this is the real big threat in the world for the United States, it's China. Russia is less so, but nonetheless still a very significant threat. Iran is, and so is North Korea, are basically unknown factors for us because we don't know from day to day whether some lunatic is going to transform the radicalism into actions that blow up Israel with nuclear weapons, or that in other ways cause South Korea to be invaded and so forth. So, or Japan to be attacked. We don't know. So we have failed to, since the end of the Cold War, defend our interests well around the world, and particularly since the Obama administration, and in the present circumstances, revealed to China, to Xi Jinping, that there may well be no better opportunity for China than now. Taiwan is essentially defenseless. They have very, very modest means by which to defend their country, and the United States has this ambiguous relationship with Taiwan that occurred because of Henry Kissinger's consent to the China's demand that we no longer afford nuclear protection and recognition to Taiwan as China. And so what we end up with is this situation where Taiwan is really a gem that has been of strong desire for 70 years for the Chinese to acquire. Having seen what we did in Ukraine, I suspect that China is going to be quick, within a matter of months to years, to actually take Taiwan in a very rapid and overwhelming exertion of Chinese power.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. To me, really, I mean, Xi could invade right now because I don't see any way that Biden would step in and stop that.
Right. And I think that's the plan. I think that essentially Russia and China have agreed on this method of first testing the waters with the Ukraine action. China's giving quiet consent or affirmation to that publicly, but I believe privately they're fully for it, of course, and they are anxious to see how we react. If we were to react in a sane manner, we would do a number of things presently and without delay. First of all, domestically, we have got to eliminate all of those orders that have been put in place that have stopped domestic oil production. So we need the Keystone XL pipeline back online. We need to encourage domestic oil and gas production. We need to enable the liquefaction of natural gas methodology for ports in Europe to receive American LNG and to work on that as a top priority so that we become energy independent and capable, as we were at the end of the Trump administration, to supply Europe with liquefied natural gas to replace Russian gas to the extent we can, and enable them to be weaned from reliance on Russia for gas. That would severely hurt Russia economically. And Russia will be financed by China to a very large extent through this whole thing. I suspect that that's a strong agreement that they had before commencement of this full-blown assault on the Ukraine. That will solidify their union against the United States, and it will beg the question of Taiwan right immediately. Really, that's right now is in the crosshairs. You can count on it.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, Russia and China just had that major accord that they struck, I think, a week or so before the Olympics.
That's right, and that's what it's all about. It's about this new era, a new era of the Cold War. It's a reinitiation of Cold War hostilities. They are now entering into a phase where they are going to pose a far greater and more direct threat. And we only have some 100 nuclear missiles in Europe. It's an old stockpile. They've been replenishing it and refurbishing it slowly. And what we ought to be doing is dramatically increase the presence of nuclear weapon systems and nuclear weapon defense systems in Eastern Europe under American control. We ought to do that promptly. That will absolutely shake Putin and will diminish his enthusiasm to interfere with NATO. It would show solidarity in NATO. It would show our willingness to defend those Eastern European states that used to be a part of the former Soviet Union from any aggression by Russia. And it would overwhelm Russia's ability to use Ukraine as a proxy to diminish the political integrity of Eastern Europe in its support of NATO. It would also give us a very strong first line of defense against any attack on American interests around the world in Europe. The other thing we should be doing is increasing our naval presence in the South China Sea and including our presence of nuclear-capable submarines. And we ought to be bolstering the defense, the submarine defense of Taiwan, and working in joint military exercises with Taiwan and forming a new alliance with Taiwan to help defend that nation against any aggression coming from China. If we don't take moves such as this, you can be assured
that
we are going to be on the defensive. Domestically, we need to have an economy that's roaring because, in addition, we need to gain an advantage. We need to refurbish our own nuclear weapon systems. We need to have hypersonic weapons. There are several that are in the works, but that we've had numerous failures in testing. But nonetheless, we have the capability, and it really requires the investment and commitment to replenish our nuclear force, or actually complement it.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, really,
and
that
to upgrade everything.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that both Russia and China have been developing those hypersonic missiles. Meanwhile, we're painting rainbows on ours. Okay, let's take a quick break. More with Jonathan Emord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys. We'll finish up with Ukraine and then Canada, and can some of what we're seeing in other countries happen here? And welcome back. Lots of things happening all around the world, but all the same theme: loss of rights, loss of lives, as governments literally trample the rights of individuals, as we saw in Canada, and even the rights of other countries with Russia invading Ukraine this week. Jonathan, we were talking about Russia and China developing next-generation hypersonic missiles. Could you continue your thoughts on that?
Yeah, their advantage there is a bit hyped, but nonetheless, it is clear that we have to develop those systems and have them operational. And in addition, we need to develop our own space-based defense systems, yeah, because they are rapidly moving into space and militarizing space. We need to be able to defend ourselves against those efforts, and we're not doing it. No, all these things would require a person with the strength of conviction, courage, and ability to lead the nation that Joe Biden simply lacks.
No, that's for sure. Jonathan, we've been talking about international issues here, and I'd like to now look at our neighbor to the north here, Canada, in the wake of the freedom protests there, and also speculate on whether what happened there could happen here. What are your thoughts on Trudeau's seizing of the emergency powers the way that he did?
So, as you know, I believe it was today, may have been yesterday, that Trudeau rescinded the Emergencies Act powers, mm-hmm, that he had assumed. But that's fickle, because he can shift at any point in time and reimpose them. And his invocation of them is indicative of a much, much more consequential problem for the Canadians. And that is, the Canadian Charter of Rights, unlike our Bill of Rights, is not predicated on unalienable rights from God. Mm-hmm. That is to say, it is instead an act of Parliament, nothing more, an act of Parliament, which by its own terms can be revoked whenever the Parliament deems it to be reasonable. And that's how they can have an Emergencies Act, and that's how they can revoke people's rights of freedom of speech and press, and that's how they can take people's property and take their bank accounts and deprive them of their right to work and freedom to travel, all simply upon Parliament's issuance of a Emergencies Act, which the Prime Minister may then invoke. This is because the rights of Canadians are not founded on pre-political God-given rights. They are what are known as positive rights. That is, rights that government deigns to give the people. Because their rights come from Parliament, Parliament can take their rights away. Because their rights come from their provincial legislatures, those provincial legislatures can take them away. By contrast, in the United States, our Bill of Rights, our founding fathers based our Bill of Rights and our Declaration of Independence, the second paragraph, on the concept of God-given rights, unalienable rights, that are rights that are naturally ours from birth, for which the state has no just claim. So when the state violates our rights, we may sue, and there is no law, even though there are emergency, comparable emergency act laws here, not quite as broad and sweeping, but nonetheless capable of abuse and have been abused, such as the internment of Japanese during World War II, that we must fight against, but we have that power, because our rights can be vindicated through Article III courts. It's not perfect in that our rights can be violated, yes, but that's the nature of the tension between any government and its people. But the genius of our Constitution compared to the poor Canadian situation is that our rights have been deemed to be natural rights. They are God-given. They don't come from the state. And our defense, therefore, is more fulsome, and the law has been strong in defense of our, at least our civil liberties. It's been watered down for our economic liberties, unfortunately.
Well, it's certainly been shocking to see these Canadians just have their rights completely stripped away from that. I mean, growing up in the U.S. the way that we have, like you say, we see our rights based on God-given rights. But when you see your neighbor, because you just kind of assume that they have similar rights and are working in a similar society. But even here within the U.S., we're watching a lot of our God-given rights being trampled on. I mean, for example, with the COVID vaccines, a lot of people tried to claim a religious exemption, and the courts, by and large, have thrown those out. So, here we have the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And yet the courts don't seem to be taking freedom of religion into account at all when it comes to the vaccines. Why is that?
Well, it's been a mixed bag, and I think that's unfortunate. I would strongly believe that people, in any event, should be able to refrain from receiving an unwanted treatment of any kind and that it arises from our liberty rights under the Fifth and 14th Amendments, and that should be the interpretation of the law. It's been a mixed bag. We've had the Supreme Court strike down the employer mandate. We've had them uphold the Medicare and Medicaid mandates. These are contradictory decisions, in my view.
Yes, mine too.
Nonetheless, we did succeed in wiping out that employer mandate. Over time, hopefully, just as it is the case with the internment camps, our constitutional rights will be vindicated. I would hope that. And at least we can continue to sue and fight for that. The problem in Canada is that the law is so squarely against the people, and imposition of these mandates on vaccination have been protected by their courts with such a degree of defense that there's nothing comparable to our Supreme Court's decision on the employer mandate. And there's no doctrine comparable to what our Supreme Court has recited about the separation of powers, for example, can enable the people in Canada to receive relief. They are very courageous for fighting against this, and one would hope that someday they may be able to revise their country such that they would have a comparable constitution. But at present, their resort is to get rid of Trudeau, who's a tyrant and who should be removed from office. Unfortunately, it appears, at least from polling data, it's upwards of 70% of Canadians endorse what Trudeau
that was
did
shocking.
To his own people.
Yeah, that was absolutely shocking to see. Okay, let's take a quick break. Back with Jonathan Emort, author of the book The Authoritarians, right after this. And welcome back. We're joined today by Jonathan Emort, author of the book The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Highly recommend that. That's available on Amazon.com, and we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Jonathan, we were talking about Canada and Trudeau invoking the Emergency Powers Act, which allowed him to use aggressive force on Canadian citizens who, unlike BLM, actually were peaceful protesters. And under that authority, he seized bank accounts without court orders, not just of the protesters, but people who supported them with donations as little as $50. He forced Canada's House of Parliament to officially authorize his emergency powers by tying that authorizing vote to a snap election because many of them knew that they could not win right now. And so little dictators fell in line to support a bigger dictator, and he has now since revoked that emergency power. Apparently, one of the reasons why he had done that was because the Senate there in Canada had not yet voted on whether or not to essentially allow that. The rumors is that they were going to have Liberal ministers, senators, I guess, go against Trudeau. So he could have been facing a very embarrassing public event there to have that emergency power essentially rejected. Would that have made a difference if the Senate had rejected that? I don't quite know enough about Canadian politics in order to know one way or the other.
Well, I think it would have, but let's be frank about this. You've got a prime minister who sees this in its application and actually used the police as thugs to beat up people who are innocent, even ones who were voluntarily surrendering to authorities, were beaten up, abused, their bank accounts were stolen, and their trucks have been confiscated, and their livelihoods have been taken away. Some people have been denied the right to work, and they've also been denied the right to travel. Now, these are abuses of executive authority from the prime minister. He would have done that regardless, I think. He is a tyrant. He is a tyrant.
Yes.
It's disgraceful that not publicly condemn these actions. He said not a word. In fact, not only should have Joe Biden condemned this tyranny in the North, we should have granted asylum to any Canadian trucker who was abused or who had participated in that protest, giving them essentially refugee status in the United States to come here to flee from the abuse of their liberties by this tyrant Trudeau. That would have been a show of strength in defense of liberty. That would have helped Canada. That would have helped the Canadians, whether they like it or not. It would have supported their liberties and their freedoms against the tyranny of the state. And we should have further imposed sanctions on Canada for these abuses. And when it comes to the American truckers, Joe Biden again will exhibit his cowardice and his lack of strength by not meeting with them. If he had any brain in his head, what he would do is actually invite them to the White House to visit with him and explain their grievances. And furthermore, his maintenance of mandates, despite scientific evidence showing that Omicron has effectively become a natural vaccine, is outrageous. Even his own, within his own party, it's fracturing because people, governors are revoking these mandates in the states. He ought to lead, and of course he never leads, he follows. He's reactionary. Biden is essentially like a very old turtle. If he is in his shell in Delaware, he's comfortable and he's fine. If you wake him up from his slumber and he pokes his head out, his first reaction is his first response is reaction, not action. He won't move. Yeah. That's the problem with Biden. He's not a leader. And now in these crisis times, we need leadership and there's none there. The public's dissatisfaction is a result of the fact that Biden has no backbone, has no depth of philosophy or opinion on anything, and is a simple rubber stamp for the farthest left wing of his party. Why? Because the radicals bark a lot, they scream a lot, and they throw temper tantrums. And for Joe Biden, give him anything and see if they'll shut up.
Yeah,
he doesn't have a philosophy. Actually, Joe Biden is a vacuous vessel. He does not have any substance. And what he instead does, he's following the political winds as best he can perceive them. He reacts to them within his own party, and he follows them. He sees that the movement part of his party is the far left, and so because it is, he does whatever they want. And it's been ruinous. And the consequences now are so grave for the United States that the 2022 congressional elections couldn't come faster.
No.
We have got to get a shift. And ultimately, Biden needs to be removed from office, but that's going to take 2024, because you certainly don't want Kamala Harris running the show, and you certainly wouldn't want to remove Harris and have the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, running the show.
Yeah, that'd be an absolute horror show. I'm sure you saw it, that Trudeau was enacting some sanctions against Russia. This was on Wednesday, I believe, and he claims that he's standing up against authoritarianism. I mean, the gall of that was just astounding.
Well, it's the old, it takes one to know one, right? He knows authoritarianism firsthand, Trudeau, because he is an authoritarian. So what he ought to do is invite Putin over for lunch, because really they share a lot more in common than they do in differences of opinion.
Yeah, it's just crazy. All right, let's go ahead and take a little break there. Right back with Jonathan Ebord. It's all about authoritarianism today, as we see more and more governments use more and more brutal efforts to assert the authority and will of those in power over those who ought to be free. We see that in Canada as blackface Hitler, Justin Trudeau, who really does look a lot like Fidel Castro and acts like him too. And of course, we've got Russia ignoring international boundaries. And even here in the U.S., pesky things like the First Amendment just doesn't really seem to hold as much sway, and merely in the way when the government wants to do whatever it wants. That's certainly not how this government of ours was intended. Jonathan, getting back to Parliament there in Canada and the fact that the Senate never really got a chance to vote on these emergency powers, would that make any difference as far as the rights of these Canadians that have literally been trampled on to be able to sue? Or is it because these all of these rights stem from Parliament, they really don't have any options?
Well, the Emergencies Act was adopted earlier by Parliament and was available to be used by the Prime Minister. What he did was expand its essential application to a circumstance that was originally not directly contemplated. Nonetheless, the Emergencies Act granted such broad authority that it was just there for the picking for the Prime Minister. So reversing or constricting the Emergencies Act would be a very smart thing for Parliament to do. And if he perceived, that is, Trudeau perceived that he was likely to lose his power under the Emergencies Act if he persisted, then that would make perfect sense as a justification for him unilaterally revoking it. Recognize his unilateral revocation leaves it in place, and so he can re-implement it whenever he wants. And so it's really just there's nothing here by his unilateral decision to end the state of emergency. There's nothing in that decision which removes from him power. So I suspect that undoubtedly the action of the Senate caused him to question whether or not his powers would be constrained. And so to preserve them, he just dropped the whole matter. But of course, at any moment, he can re-implement it.
Yeah, and that's going to be totally scary from a Canadian's viewpoint, because here your ministers had a chance to protect you. And not only did they not protect you, but as you say, that threat of reinstating that is just sitting there looming over you. In terms of how he handled the Freedom Convoy and the stark contrast between that and how he handled the BLM and Antifa-style riots, where there was actual damage done to buildings, there was fire set in some areas, and he went out and kneeled before them. If this sort of thing was to happen here in the U.S., where, say, Biden was to suddenly call out the National Guard against the Freedom Convoy that's headed to Washington, D.C., is there anything here that legally they could do? Because it was, just seems like there's this notion of equal treatment under the law. Well, you can't handle the burning and looting of cities by BLM one way and then handle peaceful protests like the Freedom Convoy another one. What kind of legal actions would they have should Biden try to do something like that here?
Well, this shows, this reinforces the conception that Trudeau is a tyrant when he does this very thing. You're pointing that out. He embraces terrorists, domestic terrorists, mm-hmm. or BLM and Antifa people who are actually committing acts of terror, burning down buildings, looting, robbing, and even murdering. And he kneels before them. And even just recently, he continuously invokes BLM as a statement of his commitment to what he perceives to be social justice. So he has sold his soul, as Biden has too, to this far left constituency. Now, the hypocrisy is profound because, as you're pointing out, he did nothing to enforce the rule of law against these people, but with peaceful protesters, he violated the rule of law when he perceived them to be communicating a message contrary to his own orthodoxy, his own political viewpoint. And this is the hallmark of a tyrant. He is intolerant. He suppresses any effort whatsoever at challenging him. He even goes to the extent of stealing their property and punishing them physically and incarcerating them without due process of law and so forth. Well, here we have the great writ of habeas corpus in the Constitution, which allows us, whenever we're detained, to petition a court to demand that the justification be presented and that the government appear before a judge and establish that it had good just cause for the arrest. And we have our Constitution's Bill of Rights, and we have other protections too. And so if the government of the United States attacks citizens who are peacefully protesting and incarcerates them or does anything comparable to what was done in Canada, all of these people would have their rights to pursue in court. Now, we know this is imperfect, and we know that the courts have decided frequently in favor of the administration. You pointed out in favor of some of these governors where they've violated the religious liberties of people by forcing them to be vaccinated. Yes, this happens, but it is our only lawful recourse. And for people who are incarcerated, that provision in the Constitution, the great writ of habeas corpus, which we have in our Constitution as a right, is a huge defense. We can't be just thrown in jail and incarcerated for a lengthy period of time. Yes, this occurred in the Civil War. Yes, Justice Taney ordered Abraham Lincoln to abide by his grant of a writ of habeas corpus, and Abraham Lincoln refused. But notice that the only written exception in the Constitution for revocation of the writ of habeas corpus is in an actual armed environment, a rebellion or an invasion. And that is a narrow exception. unlike Canada, where the exception is virtually limitless.
Yeah. Okay, let me stop you there, because the next question I've got is going to take a bit for you to answer. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jonathan Emord. He is one of America's top constitutional attorneys and author of the book, The Authoritarians, which we are seeing everywhere right now. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show. It's been a fascinating discussion today, as it always is, with Jonathan Emord, a top constitutional attorney who has defeated the FDA in federal courts a record 8 times. We've been talking about authoritarianism on full display in Canada, Russia ignoring Ukraine's sovereignty, and even right here in the U.S. And Jonathan, in that last segment there, you were talking about how the only time that we can suspend the writ of habeas corpus is in times of military conflicts. Is that why the January 6th prisoners haven't been released on bail or anything like that? Because they're claiming it was a military option of operation, I mean.
No, they are abusing the authority of the Justice Department and the FBI, and they have brought a number of these people, have incarcerated them. They've even put them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods of time. I mean, it's been now over a year. Since January the 6th. And the effect of that is a gross violation of rights, no question about it. Mm. And the efforts on the part of attorneys representing these people to vindicate these rights have been somewhat successful, but not completely successful. And the government has been given far too much leeway. The court should be compelling the government to go, come forward with direct proof of the involvement of these people in overt criminal activities. The simple fact that someone, you know, was present at the Capitol building, even inside the Capitol building, is not sufficient to allow the Department of Prisons to put them into solitary confinement or to deny them a speedy trial.
Why have their attorneys not been able to pry them out of those?
And this is an abuse of power, and the courts have not been strong enough in defense of those people's rights, I think. If I were a judge and I were presented with a slew of these cases, there are so many people who are incarcerated, I believe it's over 500 people, I would be demanding that the Justice Department establish which of these individuals among the 500 actually engaged in violent conduct. I would want to know the difference between those who committed acts of violence and those who were simply present or trespassing. And I would demand that we immediately proceed on how those people are being detained and the length of time. And I would be forcing the Justice Department to establish these distinctions and with proof. Because what's happened is that they have broadly alleged that these people were engaged in criminal activities, criminal conspiracies, and so forth, without proof of their actual involvement in violent activities. And as we know, because this is one of the most well-covered events in the history of the world, we know that there is a precious few among them who actually committed acts of violence, compared to the large number of people who are present. I am absolutely sure that there is a significant subset of those 500 or so people that are incarcerated who were involved in violent activities, who broke down doors, who against the defense of the Capitol Police, who beat Capitol Police, or who otherwise engaged in destruction of property or assault and battery. And yet all of these people, just because they have a political viewpoint that dissents from the administration, from Pelosi, they end up saying that they should be part and parcel of some sort of broad-based criminal conspiracy, which has never been proved. And they're sitting there in jail. And they should be freed.
Oh, absolutely.
If they're not, I mean, if they're not violent, and the distinction, look at the gross hypocrisy. They would release violent felons in our across the United States.
Yep. And they just bail out somebody that literally tried to assassinate that mayor down there in Louisiana, I think it was. We only got a couple minutes here, Ruth. And so real quick, one of the more shocking things that happened up there in Canada was the government just seizing bank accounts and locking people out of their own accounts. This is money that they had earned. In some cases, it was retirement funds and whatnot. Are there laws currently on the books here that could give the president broad authority to seize people's monies?
There are asset forfeiture laws, which are an absolute abomination, which allow before a party has been tried and convicted, their property to be seized by the federal government upon evidence of some. Initially, it was related to financial crimes, but it's been expanded, or financial crimes associated with drug trafficking, but it's been expanded to reach all manner of financial crimes, particularly crimes associated with things, pyramid schemes and so forth. And this it's before charges are even brought. They can seize these things. They frequently use the Secret Service for that purpose, to seize the people's bank accounts, freeze them, and then transfer the assets to the Treasury Department. This is an outrage, and it should be removed from the law, no question about it.
Absolutely. You know, for a free country, we sure have a long, long way to get back to freedom and liberty. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been terrific.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
If you only have time to read two books, you need to get Jonathan's book, The Authoritarians, and the other is Disinformation by Lieutenant General Ian Pacheva and Ron Rischlak. The first, Jonathan's book, is how leftists, Marxists, socialists, and even full-blown communists have seized control here in America, their dangerous and anti-American ideology, and what they have done to erode our Constitution as intended. You will also learn how the racist thinking of Marx was used to defend slavery and even eugenics because mankind, humanity, means nothing when you know better. Did you know that the Nazis, who are clearly peak socialists, used our own Supreme Court decisions on eugenics to defend what they did in concentration camps at the Nuremberg trials? No wonder the left wants to pretend, oh, the Nazis weren't really socialists. Yes, they were. In the second book, Disinformation, you will learn that it was not by accident that the Marxists and communists got into power, and not just in the government, but throughout society in positions of influence, and how they have seized control of the culture to twist it to their sick way of thinking designed to destroy America. And you'll learn how they manipulate, how they control the masses, and once you know that, your eyes will truly be opened. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.